Living Up to the Standard, a Bible study from Matthew chapter 5, verses 33 through 48. This message by Pastor Rod Harris was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Wednesday evening, April the 21st, 2010.
We have been called to holiness, and again, that's one of those things that we talk about rarely. It used to be a mainstay within the church. Now it's something that's talked about now and then. But I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what holiness is, even going back a few years and looking at how the church defined holiness, what was talked about from the pulpit when they talked about holiness. It seemed to me, in my background, in my remembrance, holiness a lot of the time centered on certain activities, certain things you do or certain things you don't do. And holiness was defined by activity, defined by the kinds of things that you either did or the kind of things that you do not do. But the root of the word holiness means to be set apart. It means to be set aside, to be different, to be distinct. And it is something that God does. It's not something we're able to do to ourselves. It's passive from our perspective, in that it's holiness is something that is done in us and to us by God's grace and by His mercy. When God sanctifies something, He sets it apart for His own use and His own glory. And so the biblical writer talks about those who have faith have been sanctified. We've been set apart. We've been set aside for God's use and for God's purpose. In the temple, if something was sanctified, a bowl was sanctified, what that meant was it was set aside to be used for a specific purpose in temple ritual and temple service. And it wasn't to be used for anything else. That's at the heart of what it means to be sanctified. So when we talk about holiness, we're talking about who we are or what we are. What we do is an outgrowth of who we are. Holiness starts in our character. Holiness starts in the inner part of our being, and then it works its way out. It radiates from within. That seems to me to be the message of Jesus throughout the Sermon on the Mount. Our character shapes our conduct. Who we are determines what we do. And that's why Jesus began the Sermon on the Mount with the Beatitudes and said, this is the type of person who exemplifies kingdom living. And He dealt with those issues about being poor in spirit and all of those kind of things before He ever got into the behavioral things. So we need to understand that as the background as we approach the text tonight. The other thing we need to keep in mind about the Sermon on the Mount is the whole thrust of the message is found in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 20. And I think it's important to note that verse. For I tell you, this is Jesus speaking, talking to that crowd gathered about, here's kingdom living. Here's what life in the kingdom is all about. This is the kind of life that God expects from you. This is the kind of thing I, as Lord and Master, expect from you. I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. That's a tall order. Unless your righteousness exceeds, goes beyond, is of a greater kind, is of a greater quality than that of scribes and Pharisees, you're not even going to get in to the kingdom of heaven. You're not even going to enter in unless yours is better than, exceeds, goes beyond. Now, to you and me, that doesn't sound that big a deal, because when you and I hear scribe or Pharisee, we say boo and hiss because they're bad guys. They're bad people. They didn't like Jesus. We love Jesus. But you have to understand, in the context, they were considered exceedingly righteous. Their lifestyle was a righteous lifestyle. Now, when we look at the scribes and the Pharisees, yes, they believe that their good things, their good deeds were going to gain the approval of God. But they were very sincere. They weren't wicked. The run-of-the-mill Pharisee and the run-of-the-mill person within Judaism was not evil in their intent. They sincerely believed this was the way of serving God. And they were very conscious about not doing certain things and living a certain way. So to look at them from the outside, you would think, boy, I can't be better than that. To look at them from the outside, you'd say there is no way my righteousness could ever exceed theirs. And yet Jesus is saying, unless it does, you're not even getting in. You're not going to see the inside of heaven, let alone enjoy it. You have no chance of getting there unless your righteousness is of another kind. Unless it exceeds, goes beyond. Keep that in mind as we look at our text in Matthew chapter 5. We're going to begin at verse 33. By this time in the sermon, Jesus has really quit preaching and he's gone to meddling. He's really hitting us where we live. He's dealing with issues that are really close to home. Verse 33. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you've sworn. But I say to you, do not take an oath at all. Either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is its footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the great city, it is the city of the great king. And do not take an oath on your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than that comes from evil. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn him the other also. And if anyone should sue you to take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. You've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? You therefore must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. You must be perfect. You must be whole. You must be complete. How perfect? How whole? How complete? Oh, just as perfect and complete and mature as God is. Unless your righteousness exceeds, goes beyond, is of greater kind and quality than other scribes and Pharisees, you're not even getting into heaven. Oh, and by the way, you just need to be as perfect as God. That's all I'm asking of you. That's a tall order. Now, of course, the only way we do that is through Christ. The only way we do that is the righteousness of Christ is placed in our account. So we go back to the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount when he said, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Who are the poor in spirit? Those who say, spiritually, I am poverty stricken. I don't have any righteousness. I don't have any goodness of my own. I have nothing to commend myself to God. No good works that's worthy of his love and mercy. I declare spiritual bankruptcy. Well, good, because if you do that, then the kingdom of heaven is given to you. God's mercy, his grace in the person of Christ, that he bore our sins and his righteousness is placed in our account. So understanding all that, we also need to understand that as the Spirit of Christ takes up residence in us, it's going to produce holiness and righteousness in us. We are in the process of being made holy. We are in the process of being made righteous. And that is a lifelong process. It begins when we're converted. It begins when we're born again. And it will continue throughout our days until ultimately we will be presented in the presence of God, holy and pure and righteous. In the meantime, we're at best a work in progress. What does that work look like? What are the kinds of things that we're called to? That's what the whole Sermon on the Mount is about. This is the kind of life that's expected of you. Here's the goal. Here's what you're aiming at. Here's what you're striving for. And you're not going to take hold of it in this life, but you're moving that direction. Are you going to fail? Yeah. Are you going to stumble and fall? Yeah. But you need to stumble and fall forward rather than backward. You need to stumble progressing upward. And I believe the Scripture is pretty clear that the one who began the good work in you is going to bring it to completion. That's exactly what's going to happen. But I want you to look at the life that you're called to. Because God's standard requires that your life as a believer stand in stark contrast to the unbelieving world around you. That really is what this passage is about. Your life is to be remarkably different from the world around you. And I think that's part of what the problem is in the current culture. There is a dumbing down within the church and a desire to reach the culture around us, and I think that's a worthy goal. I think that's a good and right thing for us to say. And we need to be able to reach out to those who are lost, and we need to be able to befriend them. And we often justify it by saying even Jesus reached out, and Paul talked about becoming all things to all men. But that doesn't mean you get down on their level and act like they act. It means that you reach out and love and friendship and compassion and all of those kinds of things. But your life is to always be in contrast to theirs. Your life is supposed to be different from theirs. In fact, it's supposed to be radically different from those who do not know Christ. It ought to be a night and day kind of difference. A darkness and light kind of difference. The problem is we're getting to the point that you can't tell the players without a program. You need something to tell you. This one's in and this one's out, because you can't tell that anymore by the way they live. And when you look at the statistics and you look at the studies that have been done recently in evangelical churches, when it comes to holiness and righteousness, there's very little difference between the church and the world. You look at it in divorce rates and all these other kinds of statistics, where it used to be a vast difference between the two, there's leveling out and there's virtually no difference. You look at studies that are done recently with relation to youth and their attitudes and what they're involved in and what they do. Christian youth and youth who have nothing to do with church, and it looks exactly the same. That's not the life that we're called to. We're called to a radically different kind of life. What does that life look like? That's what I want us to consider. Three distinct differences from this text. The first is, God's standard demands of us absolute truthfulness. That's what verse 33 down through verse 37 is all about. We are called to be truth tellers. We're called to be a people who are marked by the truth. And that's important because we live in an age where there is a complete lack of integrity. Truthfulness is no longer considered a virtue. It at times seems to be a liability. So don't be careful about telling the truth. Well, no, we are to tell the truth. We are to live in truth and holiness. This is to be one of those lines drawn in the sand that shows a distinct difference between the two. We are called to truth. That's in every phase of life. Now, Jesus uses a formula throughout this section. You have heard it said, but I say to you. Jesus is not establishing a new standard. Jesus didn't say, well, now, here's the way it was in the Old Testament, but I'm telling you there's something new in the New Testament about this. I don't think this is what he's saying at all. Jesus is simply saying, I'm calling you back to what the original standard was all about. He's not setting a new standard. He's calling them back to what God demanded in the first place. Because if you look at verse 33 and what Jesus says here about oath-taking, again, you have heard that it was said of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. You're not going to find that phrase in the Old Testament. You'll find it in the writings of the Pharisees. So when Jesus says, you have heard it said, but I say, he's drawing a line to show what he's saying stands in contrast to that of the scribe and the Pharisee. What he is saying is different from what the religious leaders have been teaching. He's showing a difference between Judaism of his day and what God has required of us, what God's standard is for us. God's standard is one of truth. Now, when you look in the Old Testament, you find that oaths were given for a couple of reasons. One, it was given to bridle man's lying tongue. You took an oath because you're a liar, and we needed some way to show that you're really telling the truth here. So an oath was an attempt to bridle man's lying tongue. Second, it was restricted to serious and important matters. If you were going to give testimony in a legal case, you took an oath there because it's something serious. Now, the problem is, by the time of Jesus' day, oaths weren't considered something binding and serious. They swore all the time. No, I swear I'm telling the truth, just in everyday conversation. You know, it's almost like, what's your name? I swear to you my name is... Now, if you're talking to someone and you ask them a question and they say, I swear this is the truth, what are they saying to you? They're saying, normally I'm lying to you, but this time I'm not. Isn't that what it means? Really? Isn't it what it means? If they have to say to you, I swear I'm telling you the truth, it indicates normally they're not. But this time, though, I'm really serious about that. That's what had happened by the time of Jesus. They kept swearing about everything. Now, the other thing is, and it comes clear in what he says about don't take an oath according to the temple or by the heavens or by your own head and all this kind of stuff, is because these are different ways that the religious establishment had different kinds of oaths. And if you swore by heaven, it meant one level. If you swore by the city of Jerusalem, it was another level. If you swore by your head, then it's not. And all of those were loopholes. They were ways of getting out and getting around the truth. So understand that in the context and look at what Jesus said. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but you shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Do not take an oath on your head, for you have no power to make one hair white or black. Let what you say simply be yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil, or it could be translated, comes from the evil one. Jesus is taking all of that tradition that's been built up and all of that teaching on the different ways of taking an oath and different standards of swearing and just swept it all aside and said, look, just tell the truth. Live and speak in such a way that when you say yes, it means yes, and when you say no, it means no. Now, when he says, do not take an oath, is he declaring for all time that you are never to take an oath? There are those who believe that. There are those that say if they're going to go to court, they're not going to put their hand on the Bible, and they're not going to raise their hand, and they're not going to swear because they're never to take an oath. Their yes is yes, and their no is no. He is not forbidding taking an oath because God himself took oaths. Do you remember when he entered into covenant with Abraham? God swore an oath by himself. So if God swears an oath, it's not wrong to swear an oath. What he's talking about is live with integrity. Be a person of honesty that when you speak and you tell someone something, they can take that to be truth, that you really mean it. That if you say no, you mean no. And if you say yes, you mean yes. Live in such a way that you are known for truth. That's what he's calling us to. Part of what it means to be holy, part of what the standard that God has given us, is that we need to be people who are honest and people of integrity. Now, the call to be honest is not a free pass to be rude. It's not your free ticket to be brutally honest. You ever meet a person like that, that they just say, well, I'm sorry, but I just tell it the way it is, and I just happen to be brutally honest. Well, most of the time, they're more brutal than honest. And it also means use some common sense. Yes, you're to be truthful, but sometimes you need to be tactful in how you're truthful. Tell me, honey, does this dress make me look fat? Be careful in being truthful. I'm not telling you to lie, but I'm saying use some tact in how you respond. Just live in such a way that your life is a life of integrity. That's what we're called to. We're to be different from the world in that way. that we are a people who are known for telling the truth. We are a people who are known that their word can be counted on. That's one of the things that we are called to out of this passage. A second thing, God's standard demands that we live a life of self-denial. That's beginning in verse 38. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn him the other also. If anyone would sue you for your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs of you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. Now here in just 5 verses, Jesus has given the essence of the Christian life. He said, wait a minute. I'm not sure we're looking at the same passage. How is this the essence of the Christian life? How is this boiling down what the Christian life is all about? Well, he's talking here in the beginning about the law of retaliation. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now, that's the foundation of justice. And it was given so that there would be a limit on compensation to victims. Eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth is not just a way of saying, hey, if they put your eye out, you get to put their eye out. It was a way of limiting retaliation. It was a way of saying, now, if something happens and your eye's put out, it's not justice to kill them. Justice would be an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. The point of that law was to limit compensation so that justice is done. The fair thing, the right thing is to be done. The problem is that wasn't given to individuals. The Lord didn't say to you as an individual, okay, here's the law you get to operate under. Eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. Whatever they do to you, you get to do back to them. Read it in the context. It's given to the judge. It's given to the state to set these limits. It's not your personal vengeance. It's what the state has a right to do. The problem is it was being used for personal benefit. It was being used to justify personal revenge and personal acts. And so Jesus is dealing with that attitude. He's dealing with this attitude of the individual that is determined to get vengeance, that is determined to get what's coming to them because they've been hurt or they've been wronged. Now, in this section, Jesus is not denying the right for an individual or a victim to be compensated. He's acknowledging they have a right to be compensated. But look at what he says. Someone comes up and slaps your cheek, you're to turn the other cheek. Someone sues you to take your tunic, you give them your cloak as well. Someone forces you to go 1 mile, then you go 2 miles. And the context of the third one is, in that day, as the Roman occupiers would come up to you, they could force you to carry their pack for 1 mile. They could come to you and say, you know, hey, citizen, here's my pack and all my gear. You got to carry this for the next mile. And Roman law demanded that you do that. Now, you had the right at the end of that mile, drop that stuff and say, I'm not taking another step. And Jesus is saying, they force you to go a mile. You get to the end of that mile, you look at them and smile and say, would you mind if I carried this another mile? What's the context? Living in such a way that your life is radically different from the lives of the world around you. Right? So here's why I say it's giving us the essence of the Christian life. If someone slaps your cheek and you turn them the other, then you have voluntarily forfeited your claim on retaliation. You have a right to it. But you say, I'm not going to exercise my right. Someone comes up and sues you for your tunic. You have a right to fight that lawsuit and try not to lose it. Give them your cloak, says you forfeit your claim on your possessions. You're saying, I don't own anything. It all belongs to the Lord. And if the Lord wants to take it away by whatever means, he is certainly free to do so because I don't claim any right on my stuff. I don't claim the right to retaliate. I don't claim the right on my stuff. If someone forces you to go a mile, then you volunteer to go a second mile, means that you forfeit your claim on your time and your very life. Your right to retaliate, your right to have possessions, and your right to your time and your life are all legitimate claims. But Jesus says, for those who know Him, for those who have the Spirit of God living in them, for those who are being changed by the power of God, we willingly forfeit our rights so that it's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. It's taking up your cross daily and following Him. You're dying to your rights. You're dying to your agenda. You're dying to your stuff and saying, I want to live for Christ and please Him. And that's really what matters to me more than any of this other stuff. So that's why I say it's really the essence of the Christian life, because it is a willingness to give up your rights. It's a willingness to surrender your stuff for the sake of the kingdom of God and in order to present to the world around you a life that is radically different, driven by a different motivation than anything they know or understand. The standard of God is a call to self-denial. The third and final thing then begins in verse 43. And here we have the standard of extravagant love. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemy. Pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For He makes His sun rise on the evil and on the good. He sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? If you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than anyone else? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? You ever gotten caught up in a good movie that's got a really bad guy in the movie? And the longer you watch the movie, the more angry you get. And the more you keep saying to yourself, I can't wait till he gets his. That's normal. That's who we are. In our fallenness, we love to see others get theirs. And Jesus said, your life's supposed to be different. Rather than loving those who love you and hating those that hate you, you love those who love you and love those who hate you. To the point that you're willing to pray for those who persecute you, to those who do all manner of evil against you. The world in which Jesus spoke these words were an occupied world. What does that mean? That means the Roman government was an oppressor. And everywhere they turned, they saw these Roman soldiers. And it was a common thing for them to have to carry a Roman soldier's gear. It was a common thing for them to be humiliated and pressed into service. And they hated every minute of it. And they longed for God to do something and overthrow this wicked government and get it off their back. And they were sick and tired of it. So when Jesus made this statement, He shocked everyone there. And did you look at His reasoning? So you love those who love you. Big deal. Even the tax collectors do that. You have to understand that in Jesus' day, the tax collector was near the bottom of the food chain. They were despised and hated, considered evil and corrupt. And Jesus said, oh, let me applaud you because you're willing to love those who love you. Even tax collectors love those that love them. What reward is there in that? Oh, you greet and speak to those who greet and speak to you. Wow, let me pat you on the back. Even the Gentiles, even the pagans are able to accomplish that. What have you proven by doing that? Here's what he's saying. If all you can muster, if all you can manage to do is what everybody else can do, then your life doesn't stand out. It doesn't stand in contrast to those around you. Here's when your life stands in contrast. Here's where your character shines, is when you do something that shocks everyone. Oh, and by the way, when you do that, you're showing the family resemblance. You're sons of God. You're reflecting the heart of your Father when you do that. That's Jesus' point in this section. What does it mean to be holy? Well, we don't define that primarily about we don't smoke, cuss, or chew, or hang out with girls that do. It's more basic than that, and it's more profound than that. We love even our enemies. We give up and forfeit our right to retaliate, our right to hang on to our own stuff, our right even to our own life and time. And we're people of integrity who, when we say something, you can bank on it, because we speak the truth. We don't have to constantly take an oath to say to you, no, really, I'm telling you the truth this time. When we say yes, it's yes, and when we say no, it's no. Our life is to be in stark contrast to the world around us. And it starts with who we are. And then it shows up in what we do. We have been called to holiness. And as is plain from this passage, this is not something you're going to be able to accomplish in your own strength and power. I don't care how even tempered you are. I don't care how pleasant your personality happens to be. It's not natural for you when somebody comes up and slaps the stuffing out of you. You say, excuse me, would you do that again? That's not natural. And you're not going to manage to do that just by determining, I'm just going to do that. Because without thinking, you respond, and it isn't to turn the other cheek. How do you live the life that he's describing here? Only by dying to yourself and living for Christ. And saying to him, Lord, I can't live the life you've called me to, so will you live it through me? That's why G. Campbell Morgan says there's only one person who has ever lived the Christian life, and the glory is he lives it again and again and again through you and me. It's by surrendering to Christ. How are we saved? By trusting in the grace of God and the person of Jesus Christ. How do we live a holy life? By surrendering to Christ and allowing the grace of God to live that life through us. That's our call. May God find us faithful to the life he's called us to as we learn to trust in his grace.
You've been listening to a Plowman podcast. Find us on the web at theplowman.org. The Plowman features the preaching ministry of Rod Harris, pastor of Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity Baptist Church, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.